Hello friends, welcome to Running and Fitness with Raj. This show will bring you exciting and interesting guests and give you specific and actionable advice on your running, fitness and general health. From this week for the rest of December, we will be doing a highlights package each week of our favorite guests, episodes and topics. And where better to start other than the three super elites that we talk to during the year? Dina Castor, the fastest American women's marathoner and Olympic medalist. Running legend Meb Keflezighi, winner of Boston and New York marathons and another Olympic medalist. And then the peerless Paula Radcliffe, former women's marathon world record holder. We cover a diverse range of topics with each of these legends. We start with Dina and talk to her about her book, Let Your Mind Run, and specifically about winning and losing, letting go of mental expectations, why talent is not everything, and replacing negative thoughts with positive thoughts. We then move on to Meb to talk about races, his silver medal at Athens Olympics in 2004, the setback Meb had in 2008 during his Olympic trials, and then about his highly emotional victory at Boston Marathon 2014, just the year after the Boston Marathon bombings. Finally, with Paula Radcliffe, we discuss her unparalleled early and sustained success in the marathon distance, pain threshold, and how to deal with acute discomfort in a race, her thoughts on men's and women's marathon world records, and finally, her thoughts on the modern super shoes. Happy listening, and here we go with Dina Castor.
Okay, so again, another question coming back to the book, and I found this juxtaposition quite interesting. In literally back-to-back chapters, you talk about winning and losing, which are literally at two ends of the spectrum. And, you know, it struck a very powerful chord with me, and I'm sure a lot of readers. So was it deliberate that you brought these, entirely different concepts? And again, through the lens of your running and your success and lack of success in one instance. Why did you do it? Why did you do it that way? And a follow-up to that is, again, what can readers really take from those lessons?
Yeah, it was intentional to have back-to-back chapters, winning and losing, and really understanding that both have so much value in them. To win and reach a goal isn't just patting yourself on the back and celebrating and moving on. It's really understanding the inner workings of why you were successful in that moment. And then how do you get better? To realize at the height of my career that as I'm winning an Olympic medal, to understand that I was not born an Olympic medalist. I wasn't born sure. with any of the traits that went into it, the diligence, persistence, the endurance and resiliency. Those were all traits I had to observe and learn and start practicing until they became part of the fabric of who I am. So what a great thing to reflect on in sport, that it's not just that you won, it's that you created that moment through your support system and great leadership and mentoring, that you grabbed on to all that good to allow that to transpire within you. But then also the losing. I call them like highs in the sport and learning lessons, but they're all really learning lessons. But to learn through those failures also that our disappointment is there because we care and we're invested. And how do we take that? How do we take that feeling of disappointment and make it into something that works in our favor? How do we build from that? And it's really there's a time to be emotional and really invested in the fight, but then there's a time in the end where you have to take the emotion out of it and be very strategic on how you move forward. And it's really a dance on how to do each one, when to be emotional and dive wholeheartedly into something, and when to step back and be strategic and think of those steps that are going to continue you down that path to success and continued growth. So it's a fun game, and that's what I think of it as. I try not to get too uptight and serious about the process. It's a game. We're trying to master it. We're trying to pursue excellence. We're not trying to pursue success. And there's a big difference there. It's not getting those accolades, but really trying to continue to master every moment. And if we could be that master in a given moment when that single choice is on the line, those choices build up to a pretty big reaping. So it's it's fun. And every day I consider it a privilege to be able to act that out.
Yeah. And a related thought is also about your mental expectation. And you have said that, do not let, I'm probably paraphrasing here, but effectively, don't let mental expectations lead you away, right? I mean, you shouldn't set mental expectations. You should have expectations, but it shouldn't be a kind of a ceiling or, something which constrains you. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, I have found many times in my career that when I have an expectation, I just rise up to meet it. And sometimes those are the races when I've reached my goal that I walk away saying, I was actually better than that. So why didn't I give myself the opportunity to be better, to wow myself? And that was really something that I really needed to open up and embrace, right? That, yeah, this is your goal, is to get a medal in these games. But what if you just went and strive to be better than that? And so it was really, it really takes a lot of practice because the goal has to be there, but you have to know that we always have more within us. And on a given day, when the conditions are right and the stars are aligned and the buildup was perfect, that sometimes we're better than we expect ourselves to be. And to give yourself the joy of experiencing that potential of that moment and not just falling short because you put a governor on that moment.
Okay. A follow-up question is then about, your clear belief that talent is certainly not everything. I mean, talent at best is more like a baseline and never a ceiling. I mean, that's what, I have understood from listening and reading. What led you to this belief? And especially because, earlier in the conversation, you touched upon the fact that till you really clarified your thoughts post your college when you turned professional, you always relied on your talent. So that was everything for a reasonably long period of time for you. But you no longer say that. You always say that, talent, having talent is good, but unless you do something with that talent, it's or talent you can really nurture and grow and, do much better than what you call as, within quotes, your talent limitation.
Yeah, it was actually in reflecting and writing Let Your Mind Run, it was a very sad moment for me to write about because I understood only in that moment that when I was relying on my talent, I would be on every single starting line, no matter the weekend or the time of year, thinking, oh gosh, I hope my talent is good enough to win today. And if it wasn't, it was my talent's fault. My talent just wasn't there. And if I won, it was my talent. So I didn't reap any benefits from wins and I didn't have any consequences to losses. It was just, well, that's what I have. And it was so fun once I became a professional athlete to know that I was part of that process. That was everything. What I put into it was entirely what I was going to get out of it. And losses started to bother me in a bigger way, but so did those wins. Those wins affected me in a bigger way as well. And what it came to was really putting me in the driver's seat of my life in every situation, not just in sport, but realizing that every moment I was in was mine to cultivate and create and build and grow and nurture and understand. And that was a really fun process. I was so hungry to keep living because I felt like there was so much more to discover and uncover as far as my understanding went. So it was a really it was a sad time to understand that, but it was a really rich time to be able to run away and learn so much and discover so much that the world had always been there to provide. And I just didn't understand it right.
Yeah. And, running is a, very unique sport. I can't think of any other sport where, recreational runners like myself and elites like yourself all have negative thoughts. And one of the things that you, somewhat counterintuitively to a lot of people, including myself, you say is you never say dismiss the negative thoughts. You talk about more addressing the negative thoughts with positive thoughts, like your training or what you have experienced in a similar situation, and then, you know, overcoming that while you are in a race or in a hard training session. Please take us through that, because, you know, I find it really, really powerful.
Yeah, you know, I always used to think I was a positive person until I started paying attention to how I talked to myself. I was always the teammate encouraging others and being upbeat, but wow, was my self-talk really condescending, infuriating. It was downright mean. And even sometimes if I tried to be encouraging, my tone was really off and not very nice. And so it was just simple shifts of, I hate this hill, and realizing that I was being defeated before I even stepped foot on that hill, saying, you know, this hill is challenging to me, but I get stronger every time I run up it. And as soon as those words in my head were run stronger each time, my posture changes and I ran stronger up that hill. And so our body listens to the words that we use, and the words and the thoughts that we use in our head create histochemical responses. When we're negative, our body sends out messages of releasing cortisol, our stress hormone. But when we're optimistic, our body follows through. So it's really important to talk to ourselves. It's why the psychological tactic of positive affirmations, of creating a single statement in the present tense, I am strong, I am smart, I am powerful, I am supportive, whatever it is you want to be in that moment. If we say it, our body starts getting to work to make it come to fruition. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a really good way that can benefit us. So there's so many psychological tools that we can use. I also learned that in positive psychology, it takes 3 positive thoughts to counter a single negative thought. Wow. And knowing that comes from our long ago in our ancestry, when we needed that fight or flight response for survival. Well, decades of positive psychology has now proven that we don't really need that survival mechanism anymore, because positivity gives us the better hormones to thrive and reach our potential. And so making sure that if we don't have control over a situation and we can't fix a problem, make sure we're seeping ourselves in belief with 3 positive thoughts, reinforcing, being self-advocating, but also in negativity, I have to do it in traffic. I'm sure you guys know a few things about traffic. When I'm in traffic, my mind blows, because here on the California highways, it says the speed limit is 65 miles per hour. So I don't understand how we're all parked here on the freeway. And it just makes me livid. And immediately I try to fix the problem. Well, there's really no problem to fix when you're sitting there, other than fantasizing about my car sprouting wings and flying over the traffic in front of me, which I'm pretty sure that technology is pretty soon in our future. I instead think of 3 things that I'm grateful for. And as soon as I start thinking of those 3 things, my grip releases on the steering wheel and I'm in a totally different mood. It's the same situation, but I become a completely different driver behind the wheel. So there's so many strategies and tactics. And whenever I'm in a stressful situation, I think, all right, dig into that toolbox and try to find something to get out of this. And I know, even if I'm at the crux of it and I'm grinding away trying to solve a problem, that if I don't find a tool to use in that moment, I'm going to find a new one. And that in itself is really exciting to me. So I just keep at it, being persistent with the challenge ahead.
Now let's talk to Meb. Now, you know, since you mentioned the Olympics a couple of times, I want to, you know, start with your Olympic medal. And this is something I have said in my podcast in other contexts 2 or 3 times already, which is, when you lined up that day, there were 39 runners and you had the 38th fastest time, or there was only 1% in terms of just, you know, prior timings behind you. But then when you finished the race, there was only 1% ahead of you. So just talk us through what sort of a mindset and all of that is required to, you know, to achieve that.
Well, going to the Olympics in 2004 was only my 4th marathon ever. So experience was not a lot on my side, but I was the 39th out of 101, like you said. But I believed in my coach, I believed in my training, and I believed in preparation the key to success. As my parents always say, if you do your homework, then you should pass the exam. So Coach Larson and I and Dina Caster and Joe Vigil, who were in the group, Coach Joe Vigil, we worked really hard, and we were fortunate to have the science behind us, because the United States Olympic Committee did teach us how to run in the hot, hilly, and humid course of Athens, and we put it all together. I was the 39th fastest guy. I wasn't my chances of doing well wasn't the 10K, because both teams, but I was American record holder. I've been an Olympic in the 10K before. So, but I decided the marathon is very prestigious. I want to be part of the history, and I want to be the first, hopefully, American to bring a medal. I was not going to be what color the medal is going to be. I just want to win a medal. And coincidentally, I was able to just push and persevere and kind of play really smart, run smart. And, you know, Stefano Baldini, who beat me, kind of made him over the 5K left. And then I said, 5K is a long way in a marathon. I don't want to bonk. And Paul Turgot, who was a world record holder behind us, he might be going through the bad phase, and now he's going to turn it on, you know, when he gets a good patch. So I don't want to lose that chance. So I didn't go with him, but I want 1 mile to go. I threw my hat and went for him, but he was having a fabulous day, just like I was. So I felt blessed that I was able to bring the medal here in the United States after 28 years.
Absolutely brilliant. In fact, also more than that, I remember in the year 2000, in the marathon, United States didn't even send its quota of athletes. And then 4 years later, you won a medal, Dina won a medal. I mean, it was just a remarkable transformation. And from there, you know, American distance running has never really looked back. So before I go to the, you know, some of the other triumphs that I want to talk about, like New York and Boston, I want to switch and come back to 2008 Olympic trials when you had the injury. It was a different kind of a setback for you, and you obviously came back from that. And a lot of us who are recreational, athletes keep having injuries because of various reasons, right? So, just take us through the mindset, how you overcame the disappointment, and how you pushed ahead and conquered even greater heights after that.
You know, Raj, I was favored to win that trials, and I've been second in Boston. I mean, second in New York, second in the Olympic, third in Boston. I'm like, I'm ready for a win, and so I was worked extremely hard. Maybe I overdid it, but going to the race, I felt confident going in, and I was hoping to go to Beijing to the Olympics. But unfortunately, in the United States, is fair and square. You know, to get top three, you advance. You don't get finished top three, you don't go. So the most unfortunate was that put in perspective was my good friend Ryan Shea, who was sitting next to me on the bus to the starting line, and also trained in San Diego and Mammoth Lakes with me, kind of unfortunately had a cardiac arrest. And when I finished eighth place, and people said, you know what happened to Ryan? So I was thinking Ryan Hall, he won, but maybe he slipped and fell. But they tell me Ryan Shea, they said he passed away because of a cardiac arrest. And I felt like just, you know, beat up and just disappointed. And I went to the ground. I couldn't get back up. So now that I didn't know what it was. So maybe the course, maybe just disappointment and all, and the spirit of Ryan Shea, who's not longer with us. So I was just devastated mentally, physically, and emotionally. And once I got the hotel, I was my knees and elbows moving around because I could not put a weight on my legs. So it was very frustrating. But I remember telling my wife and brother, I said, my Olympics will be New York City Marathon. I can't wait another 4 years. So even though my wife says, this is not a make a way of living, because she saw me crawling on the ground of the hotel to go to the windows. So, you know, it was a period, let's pray about it. If you pray about it, and that's what it is, the Olympic silver medal is good enough for me. But if I really do feel that there's what's internally in me, that there's worse in the tank than this what I just showed. So I just prayed, and 10 weeks later, I was diagnosed with a pelvic stress fracture. So there was some, you know, big injury to my body. But, you know, when life and Olympic is put in perspective, I guess Olympic is not a big deal versus life worth living. So I just came back from that, and then I wanted to honor him the best way I can. And, you know, so New York City Marathon, after a year and a half of physical therapy, I was able to come back. And, you know, it wasn't easy road, you know, a lot of time in the pool, a lot of time therapy and all that stuff. But when you don't lose hope and keep persevering and you want to do greater than yourself, amazing things can happen. And I was able to win the New York City Marathon, the biggest marathon in the world, with wearing the USA jersey and chanting USA, USA all the way through.
No, absolutely. In fact, it's a remarkable tale of somebody who's had such a big setback from the Olympic trials all the way, you know, in a year and a half, as you said, to come to and win the biggest marathon in the world. And the other one which has really inspired people all around the world is your 2014 Boston victory, coming as it is on the back of the Boston Marathon bombings in 2013. This was a highly emotional race for everybody. So just talk us through your race there, because clearly you came and put up a show for the whole world, but for your fellow Americans in particular. And again, your victory was something which absolutely uplifted everybody.
Well, 2014 was pretty special, but the 2013 Boston Marathon was very disappointing for all of us, and a lot was taken for us. And I was there personally. I would miss the bombing by 5 minutes because I usually don't get to see fellow runners finish. And then that day, since I wasn't running, I'm like, I just wanted to be there, kind of watch them run and what it means to run the Boston Marathon from a perspective view. And I was there for 4+ hours, and I had an appointment. I left 5 minutes later, the bombing happened, and I was devastated with the news. And just couldn't believe that such things can happen to humankind. And that evening, Bonnie Ford from ESPN asked me if I was going to come back or bring my family to this races. But I remember telling her, I hope to be healthy enough to win for the people. You know, I just set those goals. And to go back a year later for 365 days when people wore the cap, be hat or Boston hat, be strong, or t-shirt, or science, you see, you're constantly thinking about, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? And baseball is big in the United States, and the Boston Red Sox won the World Series in baseball. They put the trophy of the World Series at the finish line. And I remember I was getting massaged that day, and I tell my massage therapist, I say, I hope to do that for the runners on Pitchers Day. So there were constantly dialogue or visionary going happen. And then on April 21st, 2014, I came to win top three or run a personal best. And I told my coach, Bob Larson, in fact, before I left the starting line from the church, I said, Don't worry, you're not going to see me in the lead for until the last 5K of the race. But something internally told me, I wrote the victim's name, Martin, Sean, Ling, and Crystal on my bib to people who passed away during the bombing and the police officer. So I draw inspiration. And when the gun went off, I just was excited. And the Kenyans, the Ethiopians were trying to slow down at 5 miles. But if I'm going to win or top three or personal best, I need to push the pace. I kept pushing, and they let me have a little bit of gap, and I kept pushing and pushing, and I was wearing a watch, so I was not going over the top. I was going within myself, and there was 36,000 people who wanted to do something positive through that 2014 Boston Marathon. I was just fortunate enough to be able to win the victory, and it was hurt. It hurt a lot, but when the weight of the nation is on your shoulder, you do the best that you can to honor those people that passed away, and you can't get life back, but at least you can honor them the best way you can. I felt their spirit was with me and lift me up to the finish line.
Now we switch over to Paula Radcliffe. Now, sticking to the marathon itself, you really took to it, in the sense that in your debut race, which you won in London, you nearly broke the world record. It was the second fastest time at that time, and you were off the world record by just 8 seconds. And then in pretty short order, like later that year, you broke the world record, which you again, improved upon, which has been this very, very long standing record. In your mind, obviously, you had a fantastic shorter distance career leading up to the marathon. But in your mind, were you surprised by the kind of success you got in the marathon? The way you kind of took to it?
At the time, I think I was, yes. I mean, I obviously, cross country was my first love. And then I moved to 3,000 meters first, then 5,000 meters, 10,000 meters on the track. And then I raced some half marathons, won the half marathon championships. And it had always been a long-term plan of ours to move to the marathon. Alec and I had always thought I would be suited to it, given the similarities with cross country, with learning to manage your body and manage your effort accordingly and know your body well. And I think just also my mental temperament, I welcome the challenge of it. But at the same time, I think I was very aware that it's not about on paper, it's about how you actually perform out there. So all the physiologists could tell me on paper I was going to be a good marathon runner. I still needed to try one to see if I liked it and to see if I was good at it. So that first one, I think there was a huge sense of excitement going into it, and also a little bit of a sense of not really anything to lose. I can kind of experiment with it a little bit because it's my first one. But we were very well prepared for it. And from the minute it started, I loved it. I just felt like I found my event. And I think for lots of reasons, I think it suited my mentality. I love the fact that it's not just you against the other athletes, it's you against the distance, it's you against your own mind and your own body. And there's a lot of different strategies that can come into play, a lot of challenges, a lot of thinking time. And I like that. So I do think that it really suited me. And then physiologically, it suited me as well. I think my body for a period of time was very, very good at absorbing huge amounts of training and at pushing itself and kind of holding that red line, if you like, of maximum effort for as long as possible. And it was a challenge I enjoyed doing. So that's why I think I was suited to the marathon. I think possibly looking back, well, definitely, I probably had a shorter career because I ran them all hard.
Yep.
But I don't regret that at all because I wanted to see, one of my goals was I wanted to see how fast I could run. And I can genuinely say I probably got pretty much as fast as I could go. I might have got a few seconds on a better course, different day, different weather conditions, something like that. But I pretty much got my maximum potential, I think, at the time.
No, and as fans, we are really, really thankful that you ran your races the way you did, and you know, give us these memories, which is forever. So this actually, you just touched upon it, and it's a question which I wanted to ask you. So one of the interviews which I did very recently was with Professor Andrew Jones, with whom you have worked, and I'm probably not putting it in his words exactly, but what he was basically trying to say is athlete like yourself, who are like these super elites, could suffer pain more than pretty much anybody else, even when you go through periods of, you know, high fatigue and things like that. Now, pain is very subjective. We all know that. So can you tell us your thoughts on this, and how did you deal with parts of the race when it genuinely becomes acutely uncomfortable?
I think it's actually very complex. I think there are probably a number of, again, different levels. There is, first of all, your natural pain threshold. And there I think I'm actually fortunate, but it could also sometimes be a bit of a problem and a hindrance. But my natural pain threshold is very high. My son's is actually the same. Sometimes I could cut myself and not notice that I've cut myself until I put soap or vinegar or something in it, and then I realize that I've cut myself. So that could be dangerous also in terms of running through injuries for too long. So they became more serious because I didn't stop when I first felt pain because I didn't really feel the pain. So that, I think, is a very subjective thing that just varies person to person. And then I think within sport, there is also the ability to tune out and to kind of have that mental strength to damp down certain pain. But then you have to recognize what's good as well. So I, to put it into context a little bit, in the Athens Olympics, I stopped. I couldn't keep going anymore. Something would just not allow me to continue. I kept going to the side of the road, but at that point I couldn't push on. I wouldn't have said it was pain. It was more just not having the energy to be able to keep going. And I think complex wise, I probably hit the wall. But at the same time, my mom was really happy there because she had seen me push on through lots of other things. And she was worried that had I pushed on through that, it may actually have been dangerous. And so I was kind of reassured by the fact that, okay, when it is something really serious, I can stop, and I do stop, and I won't push through.
It was also a warm race, right? I mean, it was
It was, but I don't think that actually had any relevance to what happened to me. It was, I think, more the injury and the bad reaction, the adverse reaction to the anti-inflammatories and the treatment for the injury, which meant that I wasn't absorbing glycogen at all. So essentially, my food was just passing through undigested. So I had no energy in the race. So I did actually hit the proper marathon wall. I think that is obviously something that I learned that I couldn't push through. A lot of things like just the general pain that comes from pushing your body, I actually kind of welcomed that. Maybe in some perverse way, I liked the battle with that of being able to try and kind of ignore that for as long as possible until you actually are forced to have to slow down or stop. But I like to try and kind of push that even in training as well. And I think that was almost a kind of mental training for the race, to kind of push yourself through that barrier in training to then be able to do it in the race. And it's what all athletes do.
Okay. So one question more on the marathon and your world record. And this I actually looked up in preparing for this interview. Between the time you set it and it got broken 16 and a half years later, the men's marathon world record changed 7 times, right? And the women's one just stood, although there was tremendous progress just below your world record time in terms of the timings getting improving in most of the world marathons, world majors and all of that. Where do you see that the whole trend now going?
Well, I think on the women's side, it's slightly different from the men, maybe just because the depth isn't quite there as much. Maybe also, I'm going to put it out there, maybe women are more able to push themselves to that limit. Okay. Then the men tend to, even the world records that we've had tend to have happened with more than one person running together, sure. Not one person just pushing themselves on their own. May just be because the amount of time that the men's marathon has been going versus the women's marathon. But even if you go back historically, so before me, it did change hands a couple of times in quick succession. But before that, Ingrid Christensen held it for 13 years. Yep. So from 1985 until it was broken by Tegla LaRue, she held that record. So there is kind of history on the women's side for it to be one person kind of push the boundaries out a little bit and then it to stay for a while. I think a number of things came together when I ran the 215. The fact that I was a British athlete in the form of my life, at the peak of my career, in the London Marathon, all of that helped. I'm not sure that I would have run as fast on another course than London or Understood. Even on that London course had it not had the London crowd and the history and everything that it meant to me. So I think that helped me to get a little bit more out of myself there. And I think, yeah, I did push it and I was able to run with men in that one. I wouldn't say that I particularly had pacemakers. I was trying to think more about racing them, but I did run with the men. And then women did have that for a while, but I think there was a little bit almost of a disbelief for a little while that they could run those times. So they almost just didn't try and just concentrated on trying to win the races. And it's a different mentality too. I think a lot of those girls decided, okay, let's go for a longer career trying to win more marathons rather than trying to run fast. Whereas I wanted to win marathons, but I wanted to try and run fast as well. So you choose what you want to get out of the sport.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, as you were speaking, I was just thinking there are a couple of videos which when I go for any hard training run or races, I watch. One is those, the finishing miles of yours on that London World Record run. And the other is Sammy Vanjiru's 2010 Chicago Marathon, which the finish was between the two of them was so close. So it's so inspiring to watch both of these. So on the topic of world records, now I have to ask you about your thoughts on these super shoes. Let me put you on a spot and ask you whether do you think is it part of the natural evolution of everything related with sports and surfaces and things like that, or do you think these impart a very unfair advantage to people who do not have these shoes or have access to these shoes? What are your thoughts?
I'm relaxed about it. I do think it's an area of progression in the sport. Sure. It has always been there. The shoes that I ran in were better than the shoes that Ingrid Christensen ran in. The shoes that she ran in were better than the no shoes that Abibi Makila ran in. So there has always been that improvement there. This has been a particularly big advancement, I think. And I think so long as people kind of retain that perspective that, yeah, okay, you can run faster in these shoes. Number one factor, I think, is you can recover better. I think that's the biggest thing. And your legs aren't as dead in the closing stages of the marathon. They're not coping with the same levels of muscular fatigue and the oscillation fatigue that we used to be dealing with. So it's kind of changed the skill, if you like, of running the marathon in that it's different now. But at the same time, it's good for runners' health. It keeps the records moving forward. It keeps a healthy progression, gives the youngsters something more to aim for, also helps athletes to stay running longer. And by athletes, I mean every type of runner. So somebody who suffers with knees can run now, with sore knees can run where they maybe couldn't before, thanks to these shoes. So I do think it's a good thing. It's kind of supporting the all-round health. It's not something that is any way detrimental to anyone's health. We just maybe do just need to a little bit of a sense of perspective, I guess, when we look back over the records, that it doesn't mean that those times that people ran in the 80s and 90s, 2000s even, are nowhere near as good or on a different sheet. They were just in a different era. And I think as long as we still celebrate them for that, remember them for that, and then celebrate the new performances now, I think it's good.
It's really refreshing to hear that, because, I mean, obviously shoes are one part of athletics, but obviously there are improvements in other areas as well. Like, as we discussed, the tracks are considerably mm-hmm. different over yeah. decades. Nutrition has changed a lot in terms of what access mm-hmm. that access that you have. So yeah, I mean, it's wonderful to hear you give that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what
as you
I
very well
like,
know, some people are at the other yeah. extreme, right? Who really think
does.
That these shoes are
I do
not
find
fair.
That that's unfair to accuse young athletes or any athletes now wearing the shoes of cheating in some way. I think is extremely insulting and just
no,
wrong.
No, absolutely.
Because cheating is one thing that I absolutely don't support at all, but most of the people saying this, if they had their time again and someone gave me those shoes in 2003, I would absolutely put them on and run in them and see what I could do. So I don't think there should be any criticism of the athletes now for putting them on and running faster. They're not rocket shoes. They still have to go out there and train. They just do help in certain areas, particularly, I think, in keeping the turnover and the cadence going more strongly towards the end. So the biggest impact is in the longer distance races, the marathon, and things like, so with the challenge that Shalane Flanagan's doing at the moment when she's running the 6 marathons in 6 weeks, I think it is,
yeah, yeah.
Then it's obvious there that there is a huge benefit in terms of recovery coming yeah. from the shoes.
Thank you very much to all the listeners. Please check out the podcast website, runfitraj.com. That is runfitraj.com. It has all the podcasts, it has all the show notes, and there is a very useful search function as well. You can reach out to me on my social media handles, which are Running and Fitness with Raj on both Instagram and Facebook. And you can also email me on runningandfitnesswithraj@gmail.com. Please let me know if you have any questions or specific guests you would like to see on the show. I also request you all again to please subscribe to the podcast and spread the word. Please also leave a review on iTunes, as it will help enormously to grow the show. We will continue to bring you exciting and interesting guests and give specific and actionable advice. Stay safe, stay healthy. Until the next show, goodbye.